Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Elson, and we're set, as usual, with our Sunday morning show here at Northwest Federal on Irving Park. And as usual, the place is busy, very, very busy. And incidentally, if you haven't stopped into our new Loop location at 72 East Randolph, make it a point to do that real soon. It's a very, very convenient spot in the Loop. We're going to have a very interesting guest today and an old friend of ours, one of Chicago's top sports columnists, Ron Rappaport of the Chicago Sun-Times. And we have many, many things to talk about. There are a lot of sports questions today that puzzle the average sports fan. I'm talking about the guy that goes to a park or goes to a ballpark or a football stadium or a hockey stadium and lays his money on the line. He's trying to figure out what's going on. So we have a lot of things to talk about, and our guest will be with us in just a moment. Say, is your bank open when you're busy and closed when you're not? Well, Northwest Federal Savings knows that a good place to save is ready for you whenever you're ready. So Northwest Federal's open 63 hours a week. Now, if you work evenings, you can come to Northwest Federal 6 full days. Northwest Federal's open Monday, Thursday, and Friday evenings. And if the only time you can get to Northwest Federal, say, is 8 o'clock in the morning, well, that's okay, too, because Northwest Federal has early bird service every morning from 8 o'clock on. You'll find 6 convenient Northwest Federal savings centers throughout Chicagoland, including our great new location in the Loop at 72 East Randolph. That's just a couple of doors from Michigan Avenue. It's a great spot. Come into Northwest Federal Savings anytime. On your way to, from, or between work, shopping, or home. Stop in anytime. We're open all the time. Because Northwest Federal keeps the best hours yours. We're delighted to have one of our good friends from the sports writing fraternity as a guest today, Ron Rappaport of the Chicago Sun-Times. Ron, I was very happy as you were, and I know you were there because they introduced you. The baseball writers had a great shindig this year.
It was quite a show. It was my first one in Chicago, and I was had a wonderful time there, as so did everybody else. I've been to some around the country, but this one reminded me more of a ball game than anyone I'd been to, with the Cub fans cheering for their people and the Sox fans cheering for theirs and booing theirs, and with everybody yelling for the announcers and so on and so forth. It was a very interesting raucous affair. I don't know whether the ball players of Chicago are ready for the season to start, but the fans sure seem to be.
Yes, they are. And I thought Bill Gleason of your paper did a great job as the MC.
I did too. Bill is a great wit, we all know that, but he also did some responding to things, and he was very sharp with the things that were going on. He seemed very involved, and he really did a fine job. He kept the thing moving at a good pace, and was about the funniest man there, I thought.
Ron, as you look back on 1977, what were a few of the real big stories in 77?
Well, I guess you'd have to start with Reggie Jackson, wouldn't you? I mean, that was certainly one of the great performances in baseball history and World Series history, and considering everything that had gone before, all the turmoil on the Yankees, and the fact that at one point at the World Series, one of the writers was telling me that turmoil was typing itself on his typewriter. That word just seemed to come to him. He could do it. He woke up in the middle of the night typing that word. But to have it all come down to a performance like that, with 3 home runs on 3 pitches and then 4 or 5 in a row, whatever it was, going back to the game before, was really a remarkable Reggie Jackson sort of feat. And I guess any discussion of 1977 would almost have to start there.
Well, I won a small bet on the Yankees. There were a lot of fans going the other way. But I can remember my late father telling me, never bet against the Yankees and never bet against Notre Dame.
Well, that would have been a pretty good bet this year, I suppose. Huh? Notre Dame coming from the one terrible loss, which I saw in Jackson, Mississippi, with everybody hollering right after that for Dan Devine's scalp, and then to come on and be the number one team in the country. That was quite a story, too.
Yes, and they were a 6.5-point dog down at Texas, and that's all you ever needed.
The bowl games surprised me everywhere I went. I was out in all over the place. Every bowl game was just a shock. I was at the Rose Bowl, and we were watching the Notre Dame game before it started because it came on earlier. And we were shocked at the ease with which that game went and how poorly Texas had looked. I had seen Texas play once earlier in the year, and I just thought, and still do, think that Earl Campbell is just a remarkable player. I think he's a reincarnation of O.J. Simpson. He's got tremendous speed and strength. But to see that, and then, of course, the Rose Bowl was a shocking surprise. And then while we were writing that, the Arkansas-Oklahoma game was on, and that was another just stunning thing. That was quite a day for football. It really was. Just upsets everywhere you look.
Speaking of that, how do you account, or how does anybody account for the fact that the Big Ten does so miserably in the Rose Bowl?
You know, I just don't know. Is it? One theory is that Michigan and Ohio State leave their game against each other. And I was surprised when we went out to Pasadena and sat in on Bo Schembechler's first press conference. Somebody asked him, you know, is this game as important to you as Ohio State? And obviously you expected the answer to be, well, it's very important. It's the Rose Bowl. It's national television. Some way to answer the question in a manner that wouldn't get anybody too excited. But Bo, to his credit, I suppose, said no. Nothing's as important as Ohio State. And I can't help but believe that maybe he communicated that in some manner. Obviously, he wouldn't say so, but in some manner of preparation to his team. And he was also, I think there was a little bit of a letdown this year because they were playing in Washington, who nobody had really heard of, instead of Southern California. Bo said he wished he could have played USC because that was the team that had beaten him most recently. And the game really wasn't for a national championship the way it often can be. It wasn't two undefeated teams. It was only one. It was two teams that had both been beaten, and Washington had lost four times. And it just, I guess for some reason they just couldn't get up for this one. Now, what's happened in the past? It may well be that Ohio State and Michigan, their whole season revolves around that one game. All 10 games that precede it are building up to that. And then after it's played, and then there's a month in between, maybe they just can't get too excited for the Rose Bowl.
Either that or the Big Ten is a weaker conference than people think it is.
I don't know whether it's weaker, but it's certainly after the top two you could make a good case for that. They've got two fine teams, and they have been for a long time. But after that, it may well be that it's so easy for them to go through their schedule. Even though Michigan lost a game, it came down to Ohio State and Michigan, and everybody expected it to, including everybody else in the conference. And so maybe they just don't have to play that hard during the season, during the Big Ten season.
Ron, while we're on the subject of football, what about all the changes in the pro game? Is there any clue yet about who the Bear coach is going to be?
I heard a very interesting rumor yesterday, which is so outlandish and so outrageous that
we'll believe it.
I won't even repeat it for your listeners. It's really still in the rumor stage. Yesterday, I was out of town for a couple of days. I was at the Michigan State-Michigan basketball game, but when I came back, they're telling me now that Jim Finks isn't even answering his phone. And Jim is one of the most accessible people in Chicago, as you well know. You could get him any time. So he is really into the decision-making stage, and I would have to believe that it'll be very soon, maybe this coming week, that he's going to have to decide. My own gut feeling is that it'll be some well-trained, well-steeped, long-time assistant coach with a terrific reputation within the football community, who you and I will know as a name but will never have met. I thought the story that we had a couple of weeks ago that said it might be Ray Malavasi was kind of on the money in terms of it being that sort of person. I expect it to be somebody like that, but it's an interesting situation.
Ron, it looks like that the Pardee-Allen thing was all cut and dried.
The most interesting thing about the Bear situation to me is that here we had a coach who took a team from 4-10 to 9-5 and the playoffs in 2 years. And then he left, and yet the general manager, with whom he was at odds, and was one of the reasons why he left, apparently, because they didn't get along, came out of it pretty well. I mean, Jim Finks' reputation seems to be secure. And that seems to be one of the reasons that, although Jack denies that it was arranged, cut-and-dried sort of thing, that he was stalling and waiting for Allen to leave, that's the way it looks, and that's the impression that it's left in people's minds. And so that kind of saved Jim's face in the situation, I believe.
Well, now, you were out with the Los Angeles Times, and you're familiar with Carol Rosenblum.
Yes.
That's his new boss.
Right. Allen's new boss. That'll be a very interesting situation, because when I was there, I got there just about after George had left the second time. the time that he was fired, that Dan Reeves fired him, and that it took. The first time, we all remember, the players revolted and they had to bring him back. But all the time I was there, I heard very little good about George Allen. He had left a bad taste in just about everybody's mouth. People would say, well, he was a winning football coach, and that was great, because when he came there, the Rams had never been, hadn't been much good for many years, and he turned them into a winner instantly. But his methods of dealing with people were so abrasive and so unhappy that nobody was really glad unhappy to see him go. And they couldn't believe that he would come back, that the Rams would bring him back. Now, of course, there's been a change of ownership, and that's a big difference. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how his relationship with the Los Angeles players, the Los Angeles press, the Los Angeles fans, how it shakes down and how it works out. And it's going to be one of the most interesting stories that will be coming up next year.
Ron, how come that none of the writers printed the fact that Jack Pardee was making $50,000 a year as coach of the Bears, and he's getting $125,000 as coach of Washington? That's a $75,000 raise. That's enough to make a move, even if he liked Jim Fink.
Well, it could be. I would assume that Jim offered him a very healthy raise. I have no idea of knowing how much it would be. But when Jack, the $50,000, I think, included some bonus money. I don't think that the contract was even for that much. But that's not, if he signed a 3-year contract to begin with, he was a new coach in the league. He hadn't proven himself. And that doesn't strike me as being an outrageously small amount of money for the circumstances. Now, when he turned the team around and got them so improved and into the playoffs, certainly he had a right to expect a lot more money. And I would assume that Jim's offer would have been competitive. Whether it would have been as high as $125,000 is a good question.
Why do you suppose the assistant coach quit? You know, what's his name?
Sid Gilman.
Sid Gilman, yeah.
I have no reason to suspect that it's other than what was said, that he just wasn't given the responsibility that he wanted to have, that he wasn't in charge of the offense the way he thought he would be.
Well, were you here when he made that strange statement, 2 running plays and then throw a pass? That's no offense.
Yeah, no, I was out on the West Coast when it happened. It was a very small story in the Los Angeles. I think I was in Denver, and it was like in the small type, you know, the way we run deals. It'll say Chicago Bears in the smallest type resigned Sid Gilman, and I thought, wow, that's interesting, and there wasn't much about it in the paper there, and I had to wait till I got back here a couple of weeks later to find out what had happened. Sid had kept it within himself as far as the public and the press was concerned all winter long.
Had he been a success at Houston?
I think Sid has really had been a success in a sense everywhere he's been. He's always depended on the players, of course, but he's always been known as an innovative guy and a guy who could work with the personnel he had and who had the respect of his players and so on. But I think the problem here was that he was upset that Fred O'Connor, who was so much younger than he was given the responsibility of calling the plays. And I guess he just felt the offense just wasn't, that they weren't listening to him in terms of what the offense ought to be.
There's a rumor that he may go to New Orleans.
I hadn't heard that. That's interesting. As the coach?
As the coach, yeah.
The head coach?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Our guest today is one of Chicago's top sports columnists, Ron Rappaport, associated with a great newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times. And we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Our guest today is Ron Rappaport, a noted sports columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. What about reaction that you get from some of the columns that you write? The other day you had a column on, I read all your columns. You had one on what's happening at Loyola. I don't know what's happening at Loyola. You had an interesting column on Charles O. Finley. How did the Finley column come about?
Well, it's hard not to write an interesting column about Charles O. Finley, you know. I mean, it came about over lunch. He had just announced that he was selling the club. It had just been announced that that Marvin Davis, the oil man in Denver, had bought the club from him. And it looked like he was out of baseball, which it looked like again until this morning, I suppose. And it was... You know, I waited a couple of days, and then I just called Charlie, went over with Jerry Holtzman, our crack baseball writer, and we both had lunch with Charlie and got him in a reflective moment. And those sometimes make the best columns after the big event, waiting a day or two until the people have melted away and you've had time to think about it, and the person you're talking to has had some time to let what's happened to him sink in, and you can get them to be a little reflective and alone and to think about the past and the future and so on. And that was the case with Charlie in this instance.
Ron, I've had the opinion that had the late Judge Landis still been commissioner of baseball, Finley would have been gone a long time ago.
I don't know about that. You were telling me some stories about the judge, and of course he's a little bit before my time. The thing that interests me so much about this latest situation with the A's and with Denver is that, on the one hand, here is the man who baseball, the owners haven't liked, the commissioner, we know his animosity towards him. Now the situation in Oakland is not a good one financially, and it's also hurt the San Francisco club, which was always a very solid, steady franchise until Oakland came. Now they had an opportunity to get Charlie out of the game, to go into a city where the fans have been so turned down by basketball and football in particular, and to get a man who's got more money than anybody but three or four people in the world has into baseball and who has a very solid reputation. For all these reasons, you think they would have stood on their heads to try to make this deal come through, that the commissioner would have tried to, that maybe they would have taken up a collection, I don't know, something to get Charlie out of that Oakland lease for a variety of reasons, yet they just couldn't seem to come through with it. And that really surprises me. I had very few doubts that that deal would eventually go through. And then when I heard that it was on again, only to be crushed at the last minute, I still thought it might go through. And you can never be surprised at the foolishness that you see in baseball, especially from the ownership boxes sometimes. But this one really does surprise me. It's just a mistake on all parts, and it seems to be against their best interest not to try to make this deal go through.
Did you notice a comment that Pete Rozelle made, sort of approving the fact that Bowie Kuhn took the point of view that he did in the blue case?
I saw that today. It doesn't surprise me. Does it surprise you? I mean, commissioners have to stick together in this sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, I think had Rozelle been the commissioner of baseball instead of Kuhn, I don't think they'd be in all the trouble they're in. While we're talking about that, and I know you're close to all these sports, baseball is in serious trouble. There are franchises that'll be lucky to survive. I'm thinking of Minnesota. I'm thinking of San Francisco. I'm thinking of Oakland. There's nothing healthy about this situation. How come professional football doesn't have these problems? These guys are human beings, too. They love money as much as baseball players do. Why don't they have the problems that baseball does?
I just honestly don't know. I think part of the problem, well, yes, I guess I do think I know. I think the problem really rests with the ownership. They fought for so many years to keep the reserve clause 100% in control, and all along, the smarter people said the time is going to come when we're going to have to make some adjustments. I guess William Wrigley was saying it 30 years ago. We're going to have to make some sort of adjustments. We're going to have to come to terms with this. We're going to have with this. We're going to have to give the players some sort of leverage. And they never did it. They always said it's going to be all or nothing. Well, it turned out that it's nothing now, that the whole thing was overturned, that the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction, that there are so many big contracts, that there are so many multi-year contracts, as a result of by refusing to give a little bit, by refusing to sign a contract that the players could have lived with and they could have lived with. Now it's anarchy. And we're still in the stage of shaking down. It's only the second year of the post-Andy Messersmith decision that really turned everything over. And it'll be interesting to see over the next 3 or 4 years how it does shake down and whether, as you say, franchises do go out of business. I saw a report the other day in the Sporting News that said the Minnesota Twins had made money last year. Isn't that interesting? That they had the smallest payroll in baseball, except for the Toronto Blue Jays, an expansion club, and that they had made some money, and they actually had a fairly decent season. So it'll be interesting to see whether the Steinbrenners and the Crocs and the Autrys are going to go around collecting all the good players, or whether the candy store and operations like Minnesota can survive.
Why is it when you mention three real money guys, Autry and Steinbrenner and Kroc, and you can throw in Turner down in Atlanta, although he
Corbett in Texas.
Yeah. Corbett's got it, but Turner doesn't have that kind of money. What about the business? These fellows all made a lot of money. They didn't inherit at all. They must be have some business common sense. What about the survival of baseball? Aren't they concerned at all, or they just think of from season to season?
I think they're mostly concerned with their own teams. I figure they think that what's good for General Motors is good for baseball. You know, what's good for George Steinbrenner is good for the Yankees, and let the other teams watch out for themselves. These guys have, maybe the point is that they all did make their own money. In other, they all are proven businessmen. And they are applying the same techniques that made Steinbrenner a shipbuilding magnate and Corbett a plastic pipe manufacturer. And, of course, Autry, we know, started out from very humble beginnings and so on. And that they're applying these same techniques of getting the best people, paying the top dollar, and then looking for the return. And the hell with everybody else.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's consciously goes through their minds, but I think it's difficult to separate them from their backgrounds, from the way they became what they are today.
I'm really surprised that within the framework of baseball, now Kroc says that Bowie Kuhn should be fired. I'm surprised that the Cincinnati Reds, here's a real powerhouse and one of the solid clubs in baseball, well-operated, and they have a great record, that they haven't raised more of a furor because they really need Vida Blue along with Seaver to put them in contention.
Well, they were very upset. They said some very hard things, Dick Wagner and Bob Housham both. But the Reds, they're in kind of a funny position. I mean, here is a team that during the free agent draft, or the re-entry draft, they call it, over the last 2 years has taken this highly moral stance of refusing to even bid on players. I mean, the whole thing is beneath them and so on. Well, that was a fine stance for them to take when they were world champions, and then last year they were blown out. But then they were willing to spend all this money to purchase Vida Blue, and their point seemed to be it's okay to spend this money as long as it doesn't go to the player. In other words, we're not going to bid for Vida Blue and then pay him $1.75 million. But if we pay $1.75 million to Finley and keep the money in baseball, then it's okay. So they're in kind of a funny position. Their moral stance, at least in my eyes, has been kind of weakened. They're perfectly willing to pay the dough as long as it's done the old established way of keeping the money within the fraternity. I have no agreement with Kuhn's decision in this case. I think it was just wrong. I think you could make a case for him the first time when he negated the Blue Rudy Fingers deal. Because it was the middle of the season, because there had been no free agent draft yet, and nobody knew how it was going to work out. In hindsight, he probably should have let it go through because Charlie lost two of those three players, and now he's going to lose a third one, and he didn't get any return for it. But it was hard to go ahead and actually see how it was going to work out. This case, there's no excuse for it.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I carry no brief for Finley, but he was, in this case, entitled to get some money back for a player. He's lost $6 or $7 million already in player's value.
Well, and then there was the statement made that the Reds had offered more players and less money, and Finley was willing to look into that. Surely some sort of compromise could have been worked out where the Reds would have sent over a couple of more players and maybe would have helped the Oakland club and so on. For Kuhn not to have tried to work this out behind the scenes falls to me in the same category as his not having tried to work out the Denver deal, to try to get it to go through some way.
Do you agree with me, Ron, and you don't have to agree with me? I think that baseball is really missing the boat on one of the most attractive innovations that they could possibly adopt, interleague play. Would you like to see the Yankees playing at Wrigley Field?
Sure. Absolutely. I'd also like to see the White Sox playing at Wrigley Field, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be great. I'd like to see interleague play in terms of natural rivalries. I don't think you have to have an extensive bit of business, but I think the Dodgers and the Angels would be attractive. I think the Expos and the Blue Jays, you wouldn't be able to hold them. Texas and Dallas and Houston, the Rangers and Houston. There are some tremendous rivalries all through the league that could be taken advantage of. In the dog days of the summer when things are winding down and the teams that are out of the pennant races, I think it would be a real shot in the arm for baseball.
I agree with you. Our guest today is one of Chicago's outstanding sports columnists, Ron Rappaport of the Chicago Sun-Times, and we'll be back with our guest in a moment. Say, is your bank open when you're busy and closed when you're not? Well, Northwest Federal Savings knows that a good place to save is ready for you when you're ready, and ready to offer savers the kind of services you get with the Northwest card, a special feature available to savers who maintain a $500 balance. Here's what you get: traveler's checks, special occasion checks, registered checks, all with no service charge. Need document photocopies or lamination? It's free with the Northwest card. There's a special quick check cashing ID card with your picture. Even special vacations for Northwest card members. So get a world of the services you need often by getting a Northwest card at any of 6 convenient Northwest Federal Savings Centers throughout Chicagoland, including our great new downtown location at 72 East Randolph, right at Michigan Avenue. Be part of a special group and be a special person at Northwest Federal anytime. because Northwest Federal Savings keeps the best hours yours. I'd like to remind you again that our new location in the Loop, we have a slogan. You know, a lot of people work in the Loop. They can't afford to go, or they don't have the time to go to a bank at 9 o'clock or before 3 o'clock. And we have a slogan. The advent of Northwest Federal in the Loop is the end of Loop bankers' hours. No more of that 9 to 3 routine. Northwest Federal is open to serve you from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. Back to our guest, Ron Rappaport. Ron, what's happening at Loyola? Loyola staged the biggest upset of the year, beating Marquette. The coach seems to be unhappy. What goes on up there?
It's an interesting situation. I went up to see Jerry Lyon after the great victory over Marquette and wanted to ask him about, frankly, the party that had gone on in the stockyards the night before, which I guess was one of the great shows of all time. In fact, I made Brian Shannon, who threw it for Jerry, promise to invite me next year. Maybe you can get in, too. But Jerry seemed more interested in talking about what he considers to be the problems at Loyola. And I guess after a great win like that, he felt that perhaps some attention ought to be paid so he wouldn't appear to be whining after a defeat.
Did you have a chance to talk to the president of the school to get his viewpoint?
I did not, no. That would be an interesting point of view. They're really caught betwixt and between. College basketball has become a very high-pressure kind of business since the days when Loyola won their national championship 15 years ago. And they need coaches, extra coaches. Jerry was complaining that he only has one and that they both work part-time, whereas DePaul, just down the road, has two assistant coaches. They feel they need a gym to be able to compete for the top high school players. The problem is he seems to feel that they have to decide whether they want to continue to play a big-time college basketball schedule. And if so, then they're going to have to upgrade their facilities and upgrade their commitment, financial commitment, or whether they want to drop down and play a more minor schedule. I kind of got the impression that Jerry wouldn't mind it going either way as long as they would just decide and not try to have it both ways, to try to run a major operation on a shoestring. That seemed to be the problem to me.
Ron, thanks very much for being our guest today, and continued success to you and your great newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times.
Bob, thanks. It's been a real pleasure being
thanks
with you.
Our guest, one of the top sports columnists in Chicago, Ron Rappaport of the Chicago Sun-Times, and don't miss his very interesting and very fascinating and very informative column whenever you chance to see it in the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, in the meantime, when you get a chance, stop in and get acquainted with the nice people at Northwest Federal Savings and Loan. And now this is Bob Elson saying have a happy Sunday, and we'll be talking with you again next Sunday at our usual time.